know, I read a nice review in the Jewish Week, and obviously, with your Jewish background and the focus of the film, I mean, me being Jewish, I mean, that's what was intriguing to me and everything about the film. I'd love to know the reactions that you've had, and especially from the Jewish audiences. I think you had a screening not only with your cast and crew, but at a JCC not too long ago.
Yeah, we actually had a lot of the screenings for Jewish audiences this week. The film world premiered over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, at the Chicago JCC Jewish Film Festival. And I was there for the whole time, as were a number of the actors. And I got to tell you, it was, again, it made us very spoiled very quickly, because we had a 98% retention rate for Q&As. There was not one naysayer the whole weekend. The questions were smart. The post Q&A conversations, ad hoc conversations, were, I mean, embarrassing. It was like that Jewish Week review. It was embarrassingly positive. You know, allusions to, you know, an 80-year-old guy came up to me after the Q&A and said, "I saw Schindler's List the day it opened. This movie's twice as powerful. Thank you." I'm not, you know, and then, you know, when I see the name Philip Roth in the rave review in Jewish Week, you know, it's humbling, but it's, I mean, you're what? You're making comparisons to a man I think was the greatest American novelist of the 20th century? I mean, stop. But not that I'm not going to take it, but, you know, it's out of control. So that's what happened in Chicago. I've never had the uniformity, the unanimity of praise for any of my movies from audiences the way I did in Chicago. Then we had the screening in New York. The New York Jewish audience reacted much more the way I expected Jewish audiences to react, especially older Jewish audiences, which, and by that I mean half the audience is going to get the film lock, stock, and barrel and be somewhat and be disturbed by the film and exhilarated by the film at the same time, which is probably the reaction I hope that I get from Jewish audiences. The other half, they don't dislike the movie. They don't appreciate what I did. But the film, by definition, is a non-starter. They are repelled. They recoil. And it's the kind of thing where, I mean, they're just not going to, they will not connect, they will not accept a story about an unrepentant Nazi, no matter what the circumstances are, end of story. No matter how well it's made, no matter how brilliantly it's acted, even, you know, and of course something I do tell audiences after I, you know, after they see the movie, is that of the five lead characters in the film, of the five lead actors in the film, the only one who's Jewish in real life is Rebecca Shaw, which is absolutely true. But those are, you know, and I kind of knew that was going to be the case, this 50-50 divide. And the Chicago was not, I mean, of course, we got a little bit spoiled. We kind of said, well, maybe we're wrong. Maybe Jewish moviegoers are just smarter and more sensitive to art and what the art is trying to say. And the challenge that the filmmaker, you know, the gauntlet the filmmaker has laid down before us, we get it. And in Chicago, they did. But when I, in recent years, I distributed two films directed by Hani Abu Assad, a two-time Academy Award-nominated Palestinian filmmaker, a filmmaker who learned his craft going to school in Tel Aviv, not Gaza. You know, but he's a hardcore Palestinian filmmaker. And obviously, the films were successful. They were critically acclaimed. They were nominated for Academy Awards. Only one that I distributed was nominated. The other one was his previous film. But then I distributed his latter film, his next film. And I saw that divide, whereby there were probably 50% of frequent filmgoers who were Jewish in hoity-toity, you know, upscale, you know, college-educated neighborhoods like the Upper West Side of New York, who wouldn't even go to the movie because it was directed by a Palestinian filmmaker. So I knew that there was going to be a dichotomy. I knew that there was going to, there were going to be some, you know, sides taken. And that's what we saw in New York. That's what we saw in New York the other night. There weren't many walkouts, but they didn't know what they were coming to see. And they didn't even want to talk to me. They didn't stay for the Q&A, those 50%. And then the ones who stayed, they got it. And I expect that's going to happen a lot. And it doesn't ward me off. It doesn't frighten me. It doesn't intimidate me. You know what? All of my films, I think all of my films are provocative to some extent. And somebody asked me at a Q&A in Chicago the other night, what do... Oh, no, no, no. This was Isaac Zabaki, the film curator at the JCC. His final question, he was moderating the Q&A. His final question is, well, what do you want audiences to take away from this? And I paused for only a split second, and I said, I just want audiences to see the pro and con. I want it to stay in their heads. I want it to stay in their minds. I want it to be unforgettable. And that for days and weeks, you know, whether they loved it or recoiled in horror, I don't want them to stop thinking about it. And if that happens, then the people who don't accept the film because of the construct, because of the conceit of the story, then that would be thrilling to me.
Well, I know it's a limited release coming up, but I hope you'll swing by Dallas as usual, and I know we love your work here.
Yeah, we definitely want to come down there. I'd like to squeeze into Austin for a change.
Oh, that would be wonderful. So to kind of continue on the jump back to what you were talking about, the incredible cast, I do want to ask you to talk about Rebecca's performance, and not only of the fact of how amazing it is that her being the only Jew and her tackling that character, but just the wonderful moment on that beach. I was blown away by that scene. I hope people see the movie just for her sequence with Jill and AJ on the beach. That alone is one of the best scenes I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the kind of scene where if you show this script to a potential financier with that 33.5-page sequence in it, which included an 8 or 9 or 10-page monologue, I don't know what it was, you're going to be thrown out of the office. And yet, it in rough cut screenings, And when I say screenings, we really only had room to squeeze 2 to 4 people in and to watch it various cuts of the film on an IMAX. But I've never had this happen before, where 100%, honestly, most of the reactions at the rough cut screenings were good, and it just helped us shape the film further. But whether it was one of the few people who just did not like the film or were Jewish and they just would not, you know, it was a non-starter for them, the one comment, everybody, 100%, the same comment when the lights came up. Who is that woman? Everybody was blown away by that. And it was, you know, and when you begin with something that on paper is so audacious, it's not always going to work. And I give full credit to Rebecca Shaw. Again, it's the fourth time I worked with her. And when I finished the script, I kind of wrote it for her. I mean, when I knew I was going to write a character who was 92 years old, she was the person, you know, when I worked with her on film, she was acting, she had to, you know, act older than she actually was. She turned 92 weeks ago in real life. I began working with her when she was 76 with Flannel Pajamas. But there's a big difference between 76 and 90. I don't know how many Hollywood film producers would want to take that risk. You know, it's bad enough that ageism in film and actor hiring exists at the, you know, when a woman in particular turns 65, but how many roles, you know, are going to be offered to women who are about to turn 90? I finished the script, and I never engage the services of an actor or a crew member before I know I have all the money to make the movie, to finish the movie. In this case, I made an exception. When it looked like the money was there, but I didn't have it lock, stock, and barrel. But I said, I'm going to take Rebecca out to lunch, and I'm going to print out a hard copy of the script, because I have to know she's in. And so I met her for lunch, and we had a nice, lovely, innocent lunch. Gave her the script. I said, I wrote this for you. I said, I want you to do it. Read it and get back to me. She called me 2 days later. She said, Jeff, it's very disturbing, but I think it's amazing, and I'm in. But then, you know, and remember, you know, just in terms of production, oh, and then I always meet with the lead actors in my film as often as they'll let me. I don't rehearse. I don't like to rehearse. They don't like to rehearse. They want to be absolutely spontaneous and fresh on set. And in fact, I seldom do more than one or two takes of any scene, no matter what the length. And if it requires more than two takes, I know I've miscast the film. So with Rebecca, I went over to her apartment on many occasions, largely to talk about what accent she was going to try to adopt for the role, and that took a little doing, you know, to find the right tone, to make sure that, and then to make sure she was going to be comfortable with all of the dialogue she had to say. I don't mean thematically or you know, the underlying character. She wasn't trying to change that. It was just the words had to flow smoothly. And then a few times she would not so much catch a mistake, but say, you know, at that time in Germany, wouldn't she say this or wouldn't she say that? And sometimes I would agree with her and sometimes not. That would change a line of dialogue. Nothing. Once we get to set, what you saw in the movie, there's not one improvised line. It was 100% script. But I will modify, you know, to strengthen the actor's comfort level with their character when we're in pre-production. And so I probably spent 5 or 10 days visiting Rebecca at her apartment to go over, and really, we parsed every single line in that monologue. And sometimes I'd have to explain what my intent was. Sometimes she would catch something that if I changed a word or a line, it would make her feel more comfortable as that character. And I think she, you know, when we did change it, she was right. So that when she got to set, it flowed. It flowed from her easily. And even at the age of 89 and a half, you know, she delivered something that was truly dazzling and otherworldly in terms of its quality and its plausibility and believability. And remember, even though the monologue is 8 or 9 pages, we didn't shoot it in one take. And when I met with my DP for the first time, I said to him, well, look, this is a monologue. You know, her two great-grandchildren are in virtual shock, which is why she's able to go from start to finish without really being interrupted until the end. But so we have something that's going to be close-up, close-up, close-up. I said, can you think of a way, without being over the top, without being obnoxiously obvious, that we could do in terms of cinematography to make it a little subtly different? And he came up with this great idea. He said, just break it up. Break it up into 8 or 9 takes. And as the monologue goes on, we'll start with a medium shot without the audience even realizing it. We'll push the camera closer to her by 10 inches every page. And we'll cover it with reaction shots. And those reactions, I mean, that's one of the hardest things to do. With no words, deliver reactions to something like this as Jill Durso and A.J. Cedeno do in this monologue. But by the time we finish, without the audience even being aware of it, we're a pretty tight close-up of Rebecca. And that helped because, you know, I don't know how many, you know, if you're a stage actor doing it every night, obviously 10-page monologues are, you know, like falling out of bed. But on a film set, it's not the same. And that's kind of how that happened. And also, the other thing to remember about the beach sequence, which I call a symphony in three movements, is that when she tells this remarkable story, which begins as a love story and winds up as one of the most compelling horror stories of all time. She has really just rocked the foundation of the two people who love her the most in life. And, you know, how do you turn 30 some odd years of abject love into hate in 30 minutes? And so that's shock and awe is the first movement of that symphony. And then even physically and positionally, the next theme, Olivia is situated between her husband and her husband's now mortal enemy. And that is all about, okay, now I'm going to ask you questions, and I want the right answers. And they're not the right answers. So that becomes the first salvo back. And finally, he can't deal with it and goes to take a swim in the ocean after he says, I'm not even Jewish. And then the third movement is outright warfare. And where they are literally shrieking, you know, accusing and shrieking. And it finally, of course, I never, in any of my movies, which obviously are exercises in dialogue wall to wall, much like my present-day hero, Aaron Sorkin, so I don't overuse profanity because I think it takes its power, you know, it loses its power when it's overused, like it's overused by almost every young independent filmmaker who manages to make a movie these days. But when, you know, this beach scene rises, almost like the Beatles' Day in the Life, with that last piano, you know, that last piano note, when Josh finally, she says, Josh, your 92-year-old great-grandmother has terminal cancer, and he finally said, this is a modern Orthodox Jew who loves this woman more than anything in his life, at least until he married Olivia, and he says, fuck you. That's why a simple fuck you becomes one of the most powerful fuck yous, I think, in cinema history. And, of course, that rather darkly comic coda, once he walks off, where Olivia says, this is where I'm supposed to say, he doesn't really mean it, but I actually think it does. And then the countdown clock, literally on screen, starts. And the other lovely thing that, I'm sorry, now I'm getting off your question. I was going to say, even the actress who plays Julie Fane Lawrence, who plays Melody, it's not that she didn't realize it, it's just that she was busy acting. Is that when she has that lovely evening moment, of appreciation for her husband's exhilarating work on his graphic novel, when she tells him, it's great, you know, also a moment. That whole night scene where Reed is crying, that's her birthday. Mm. And we know that because at the beginning of the graphic novel scene, when Olivia asks Reed, where's Melody? And he says, upstairs, she hasn't come out of her room in 2 days. She got Olivia response by saying, Friday's her birthday. One of the other things I love, I'm sorry, I'm going off on tangents now. One of the things I love, which an audience will never recognize the first time they see the film, and they should, I can't expect them to. Their memory with all of this dialogue and all of this information is just not going to permit it. But the very, very single first line of the movie, in a dark way, completely is what happens in the movie, all the way to the end, which is when, on Rosh Hashanah, in Central Park, Olivia says, on Rosh Hashanah, we gather at a lake, river, or stream, and symbolically cast away our sins, so that we can start all over with a clean slate.
Mm.
And that's the entire movie in one line.
Well, I'm glad you went on that tangent, and I'll give you one last chance for a fun tangent, because I think, as my last question, I'd love to ask, Julie has one of my favorite lines in the movie, where he's talking about needing to become Jewish again. AJ's character, Josh, because of all that he's now learned. And she brings up
his foreskin.
His foreskin. Can you tell me a bit about that line? And you know, I just, that made me laugh out loud.
Well, and the funny thing is, it's funny you should say that, because it's my favorite bit of directing an actor on this movie was when he says, it's just a drop of blood that's necessary this time, and she responds off camera by saying, really? And she wasn't understanding that she's supposed to say that, and then it's cringing. I mean, one of the most horrifying things about my little boy's penis that he's ever heard. The line is because most, in my experience, as a conservative Jew, nobody, you know, there are circumstances, far more benign circumstances, where a Jewish man is circumcised. But obviously, he was already circumcised by a doctor, if not a moyle, when he was born. But, you know, there are still circumstances that prevail that a male will be circumcised, and it becomes a symbolic circumcision. And the moyle does extract, a single drop of blood. And conservative Jews aren't aware of that. Most are not. They don't know about those kinds of rituals because it never would come up. And obviously, Harry grew up, his father, Harry grew up a conservative Jew and was circumcised, but he's not going to go to symbolically convert to Judaism now like his modern Orthodox son. It becomes a moral imperative. Anyway, does that kind of conservative Jewish mother, you know, her immediate response to, you know, the fact that his son announces he has to be circumcised next week is, just incredulity, and have her say, "Honey, not really possible, is it?" I kind of was I was an eyewitness to the event. I thought it was a funny little moment, just as I think, and I thought it was appropriate tonally to that rather unusual scene. And the actors in that bathtub scene, I explained to them, this is the only moment since after the beach sequence for the rest of the movie where most of the family finds a hiding place and exhales. It's the only moment when they all exhale. I told them this bathroom becomes your fortress of solitude for just a little bit, just an hour. You know, Claire's in the house somewhere. The Nazis in the house somewhere. This is Anne Frank's basement.
So cool. Well, Jeff, I'll kind of last kind of moment question. I would love to know if there's any info you can give on what you're working with on the Leonard Cohen picture and just any tidbit of what you're hoping to show us with that.
Well, it's not quite finished yet because I've been working on the release of this film. But the only thing I will tell you is that it's my personal, it's going to be very much like my other films in that it's about a family and all the members of the family. But it is, the log line is that it is my response to the Me Too movement. And it's not going to be pretty.
Great tease. Well, Jeff, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. I hope we chat next for the next film and
thank you for spending time again with my work. I really appreciate that.
Well, we'll talk soon, and Jeff, have a safe trip. I know you're about to get on a plane.
Yeah, thank you very much, and continue to enjoy those Cassavetes DVDs.
Will do. Thanks, Jeff.